Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological, and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcast offers. I dare you.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club, which comes to you direct from the Edinburgh International Books Festival. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. The event took place in a very different sort of space, not our usual Guardian headquarters in King's Cross, but a tent in the middle of Charlotte Square. And of course, it brought with it a spanking new audience for this month's guest, Pat Barker, who came to talk about her First World War novel, Regeneration, published 21 years ago. Of course, it became a trilogy under the same generic title. So John Mullen began by asking Pat if writing a trilogy had always been on her mind.
Well, I tried to write the last chapter of Regeneration, which, as you know, is quite a simple chapter. And I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, and it never worked. And the reason was I was trying to produce a sense of closure, horrible word, but that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to tie up all the ends. And if you think about it, there is Siegfried Sassoon going back to the war, and he still doesn't believe in it. There is Billy Pryor, who he thinks has been deprived of the membership of the club to end all clubs. And there is Rivers, who has been forced to question his own views on the war very fundamentally. And no way is this the end of the story. So at that point, I decided to write a trilogy. So it began by being one book, right. Then it was three books. It was never two. Okay. I don't know why it was never two, but it never was.
So you only, it's only, it was only, as it were, when you're getting really close to the ending of this novel.
Well, I'd finished it.
Yeah,
I'd finished it. I just had a last chapter that didn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if I'd known it was going to take me another 6 years to finish that chapter, anyway.
And did that mean that when you... When you went on to write the second and third volumes, The Eye and the Door and The Ghost Road, that you sort of, as it were, went back to Regeneration and took out things which were implicit there? And, I mean, can I give you an example?
It would be nice if that had been true. But no, I decided in The Eye and the Door that what I wanted was a character who went into fugue states. And was, you know, and his had long episodes of time in which he couldn't account for what he was doing, and I tried to write that character over and over and over again. You know, I am not an efficient novelist, and then I thought, Billy Pryor, he'd been there all the time. I'd enjoyed writing about him. So only at that point did Billy Pryor come into The Eye and the Door.
Right. Okay. Because it does seem that he is going to be. I mean. And give away the ending of the whole trilogy, but it does seem that we know, of course, what happens to Owen and
yes.
Sassoon. If we want to know, we can know as well.
Yes.
But Billy Pryor is a central character who's the most central character who's fictional, and it feels like his story does need to be sort of completed. And well, I assumed he'd be there at the close, I guess.
As indeed he is,
yes.
Of course. Because he's twinned with Owen in a sense, you know, they share a lot of experiences. But I mean, I tried to finish Billy Pryor off in Regeneration by giving him home service. But then in Eye and the Door, he is reclassified as fit for service at the front towards the end of that book. And that was what happened to a lot of people.
Yeah.
If you were given home fit for home service only, that lasted until the next slaughter. And then suddenly you were a lot fitter than they thought you were the last time they looked at you.
And so what about the sort of What seems a kind of stroke of inspiration, a fictional inspiration, which was to have a book, which was a novel, which was about the First World War, which sort of wasn't located on the Western Front.
No.
I mean, did you set off with the, you know, terrible sort of thought that, sort of, that you wanted to write a novel about the First World War, or was it the story of rivers and shell shock that first?
I did want to write about the First World War, but I didn't want to write a pseudo-combatant book,
yeah,
which is quite easy to do, actually. You just soak it all up and you produce it. And in the end, there are five senses. And if you get what those five senses are experiencing right, you will make people feel they're on the Western Front. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write from our perspective. And our perspective is essentially people who know quite a bit about it and are very sympathetic, but we haven't been there.
Yeah.
And that is the position that Rivers is in. And to me, however powerful Billy Pryor becomes, Rivers is the centre of the book.
Yes.
And crucially, he has never been there.
I was going to ask you, actually, is he in a way the kind of, I don't know, the novelist surrogate or something, or the reader surrogate?
Oh, I wouldn't tell.
But he keeps being, he gets told by people, oh, you can't imagine this, or,
yes,
you know, it's impossible to imagine. And it does seem that, I know this may sound like a sort of literary critic's false ingenuity, but it feels like the difficulty of imagining what it must have been like is sort of built into the structure of your novel, really, because of the role Rivers plays. And we're in a way in that same sort of position. I don't know, that's how it felt to me.
Yes, I think that's exactly what I intended. I intended a certain distance from the experience of the front line. And you go in regeneration, you go to the front in the form of a battle nightmare.
Yes.
Repeated battle nightmares for some people, which was the most frequent symptom of shell shock. But you don't actually get to the front until the second half of The Ghost Road.
Yeah.
A long, long time afterwards.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that Rivers is in some ways, you think, the sort of the central character, because the striking thing about regeneration, the way the narrative works, is, I suppose, the simple fact that you get lots of different points of view.
Mm.
And you must have been, I don't know if you can recall the process of sort of how you decided, moving about between different points of view. Were you kind of conscious of how you shared out people's characters' thoughts and viewpoints when you wrote it?
Rivers was idolised by his patients. I mean, they probably got better because they idolised him rather than because his particular theories about psychotherapy worked. But Sassoon adores him. A lot of the other patients adore him. And because of that, he remains what he chooses to be, as Pryor says, your empathic wallpaper. Now, from my point of view, I can't afford Rivers to go on and on being empathic,
yes,
wallpaper. He's got to be needled into doing things and revealing things. And the whole purpose of Pryor, really, is to needle Rivers into revealing things about himself, which he wouldn't choose to reveal. And, you know, the moral tone in Regeneration is quite high. You've got Rivers, who many people think of as a saint. You've got Siegfried Sassoon, decorated war hero. You've got Wilfred Owen, tragically gifted young poet, possible genius. And, oh, dear me, it's time for a bit of light relief. And then so when Pryor and his sexual ambivalence and his probing and his wanting to get his leg over comes in at that point.
But you decide who else. I mean, there's some other points. Sarah,
yes,
whom,
yes,
he has a relationship. Even the word relationship seems curiously evasive, actually. But with you, you give us a section from her point of view, sitting around with the other women.
Yes, yes, yeah, and the shock and the horror of abortion as,
yes,
they slot them, the bullets into the machine gun. Belts.
When you're writing, did you as a novelist, as it were, feel free or restrained about, as it were, whose head you go into?
No, I was quite interested in exploring very different characters. And also, I do think if, as a woman writing about men, or for that matter, a male novelist writing about women, if I think if you're only in one character's mind, you sort of start thinking in terms of gender. Mm. Whereas, in fact, if you've got three or four men who don't agree with each other about anything and are fundamentally different characters, that issue of gender goes into the background.
Yes.
And you are simply writing about three or four very different individuals. And at that point, you relax and it comes more easily.
I mean, it's funny that you say that some of them are quite kind of high-minded. It strikes me that actually the effect of doing this is in some ways to... I think that's almost the thing I like most about the novel, is to make the reader, make me, quite uncertain about where my sympathies might lie.
Mm. Mm.
Because actually it turns out, I mean, first of all, just as you're getting used to following one person, you get a jolt and you're off somewhere else.
Yeah.
But also, I suppose, because quite often what it reveals is that some of the characters whose behaviour may seem fine have sort of motives which are quite sort of peculiar or troubling.
Mm.
So you mentioned Pryor, for instance, his sexual ambivalence when he gets his leg over for the first time under a bush.
On a grave, yes.
And you get this really quite unpleasant sort of mixture of feelings he has for this woman, a sort of mixture of allure and affection on one side and sort of contempt as well on the other. And I just wondered if, I mean...
I don't think he despises her as a woman or a working class girl.
No.
I think he despises all civilians.
Yes.
Yeah, and as Sassoon does too.
And I mean, is that... Were you conscious of that, that the sort of... that unsettling our sympathies might have been...
I think what I was conscious of is that the poetry of Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, along with later the landscapes of Paul Nash, sum up our cultural inheritance about the war. And the difficulty I found was to make the point of view of William Rivers and Robert Graves sympathetic. Graves, who says, you took the king's shilling, you put the uniform on, you have to do the job.
Yes.
You can't make a contract and back out because the price of fulfilling it is higher. And when the film of Regeneration came to be made, and I was talking to the director, mainly I talked to, it was very difficult for them to get past the poetry of Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon and get to the position where intelligent, sympathetic, well-meaning men thought the war had to be fought and had to go on being fought. That was the challenge, really.
Yeah, because even Rivers, I mean, in Regeneration, we get told quite early in the novel what his beliefs about the war are, and... If we're looking for sort of to sympathise with him because he's the humane person who deals with the victims and knows how awful it is, we actually find out that he believes the war needs to be fought to the finish. And
that's right. You see, there are cast iron reasons for not fighting this war. Are there any cast iron reasons for losing it?
Yeah,
it's a different question.
And the characters, all seem at certain times anyway to want to go back to the front.
Oh, yes, because, I mean, the civilian life was so intolerable to them. Not just war-sensitive war poets, but a lot of perfectly ordinary men wanted to go back to the front, because the level of incomprehension from their nearest and dearest and the level of jingoism on the home front was just intolerable to them, knowing what they knew. Mm. And there were even men who, throughout the 4 years, took no leave. They just... didn't go back to England. They took their leave, but they took it in France. They couldn't bear it.
One really obvious thing that I haven't asked you about is the title of the novel, Regeneration, which sort of became the name, I don't know whether by design or just by the votes of readers.
Well, I wanted to call it the Rivers Trilogy, but Penguin pointed out that it would be classified under geography. They weren't prepared to take the risk.
I mean, Regeneration, of course, has a specific meaning in the novel, which is then picked up in the next volume, of these sort of experiments that Head and Rivers did on nerves, absolute nightmarish sounding self experiments.
Yeah, I mean, basically Head's median nerve was severed, and then they plotted the path to recovery, because they believed that, you could do this in animal research too, but the animal can't tell you exactly what's happening. And they wanted somebody who could tell you. And Head, in fact, was left with a sort of triangle of loss of sensation and pain on his arm at the end of 4 years. But it was a monumental effort that went into it.
But it, as a title for the novel, I found it tempting. You can correct me, though, Pat. I found it tempting to find it almost sardonic, or ironical anyway, because it seems...
Well, it becomes so when you think what the state Billy Pryor is in the next book. He clearly hasn't regenerated very much. I mean, the River's Head experiment is fascinating, because my husband used to use it in his lectures, because one of the things they did, apart from tracking this, is to prove that the penis is insensitive to touch. Blindfolded Head had various things done to his knob, like ice cubes, wisps of cotton, and it is actually insensitive to touch, as you would expect a battering ram to be. But my husband, faced with a lot of 18-year-olds who were just overawed and inclined to take everything that was told them for granted, said the penis is insensitive to touch, and they were, the penis is insensitive, and mutiny set in at that point. But, so did scientific thinking, that they didn't believe it.
It's time that I gave everybody here the chance. So have we got the mics? Where are the mics? If you'll get it. Yes, you, sir. You start. Yeah?
I met Harry Patch a few years ago, who is the final Tommy, as it were. Mm. So now he is dead. There is no living memory of the historical era that your work is based in. Mm. So I suppose, I don't know, will there be a repetition of that degree of human suffering through formal warfare? Maybe the world changes in different ways, but I'm just making that statement.
Oh, I think, unfortunately, that this degree of suffering has been already repeated all over the world, in Kosovo and Sierra Leone and places like that. People have undergone terrible traumas. Unlike most people, I know that the death of the last survivors, I was privileged to meet one of them who lived to be 103, and was as clear as a bell mentally, and remembered it all. But, even at the earliest ceremonies at the cenotaphs, the living, who were then young men, of course, but the living there were there really to represent the ones who couldn't be there. They were there to represent the dead. And I think right to the end of their lives, these very, very elderly old gentlemen were representing their dead comrades. And I think when the last of them went... I don't think it changed things as much as people thought, because I think the thing about the First World War, as indeed about most wars, is that the dead are always young. And I think young people reading the poetry of Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen are not thinking about the elderly men in wheelchairs. They're identifying with young people like themselves who went through this almost unimaginable experience.
For me, when I read the books, it was... utterly profound getting inside that period of total social change. And I think you did an amazing job of allowing you to realise what it's like when the whole world turns upside down and everything, gender, class, sexuality, psychology, national identity, everything changes.
Cool. That's quite a lot.
What was I trying to represent a society in complete upheaval? Yes. And I think specifically I was interested in the way sexual roles were re-evaluated during the war, and the way in which men, to a certain extent at least, were trying to re-evaluate their roles, which had led them, but going on accepting it at the same time. And, it's a good way of dealing with it, isn't it? Because, in the 70s, you had a lot of men in Hampstead a sort of going off into periods of angst because they weren't loading the washing machine or doing their fair share of the ironing or something like that. But you contrast that with the kind of questioning of where masculine values led on those battlefields. And it's a much more profound questioning. And for most men, of course, it was questioned across all classes, but they went on picking up the burden.
Sir, gentlemen here.
Thank you very much. I too enjoyed very much your books, and I was very impressed by the extent and depth of your research, especially in respect of the war poets. And I just wondered, did you at any stage have a chance to speak to the descendants in any way of people like Mr. Owen, Mr. Sassoon, Mr. Graves?
I think I met Owen's uncle. The way in which Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen worked together on What Passing Bells for These Udaya's Cattle, and the way in which the poem is transformed as they work on it, you cannot. It's in the English library at Oxford. The manuscripts are there, and actually the amendments that Sassoon suggests in Regeneration are in his handwriting on the manuscript. And under his influence, really, Owen completely changed the tone and meaning of that poem, and it became, of course, very, very powerful. Though, as Sassoon says right at the end, I believe, you've still contradicted yourself. The first stanza says, nothing is worth it, and the second stanza says, yes, it is.
Can you hear me? Do you, as a novelist, have any sympathy with Sassoon's statement that by 1917 the war was being conducted in the personal interests of a small minority of influential people?
I think as a novelist, I'm not obliged to take sides. I sympathise tremendously with the shock and horror Siegfried Sassoon felt. And I think there's no doubt that individual people and companies were getting rich very, very quickly. But I also can see the merit in William Rivers's view that the war had to be fought. I mean, there are lots of reasons for not getting into the war, not very many good reasons for losing it. You know, those are two quite separate things. So much of our understanding, cultural understanding of that war is based on those two young men in a room in Craig Lockhart working on poetry, Sassoon and Owen, and in the landscapes of Paul Nash, all of which emphasize the futility and the waste. And yet there are people then, and there still are, who believe that that was a war that needed fighting. And the whole, my point as a novelist is that I have to create a balance and a conflict between the two points of view in order for there to be any conflict in the book at all. There would be no conflict if Sassoon was, in a completely simple sense, right.
My great uncle fought in the Great War and spent many hours telling me about it. I didn't have the sense or the means to record what he told me. The thing that surprised me most was his very ambivalent attitude to the enemy. He made a big distinction between enemies and different types. For example, the Prussians were unrelentingly ruthless and evil. Mm. Saxons, they were our sort of Germans. Yes. You know, they didn't muck you about if you didn't muck them about. He reserved a lot of his contempt, actually, for the Siegfried Sassoon types who came from nowhere, upset your enemy, and set all things, sorts of things going when there wasn't a big offensive or big defensive action going on. Did you pick up any of that from the reading that you've done?
I didn't pick up dislike of Siegfried Sassoon personally, though he was known as Mad Jack. Because he did such extraordinary things. I do know about the feeling that if you had a Prussian regiment opposite you, it was very different from having a Saxon regiment. But of course, because all the changeovers took place under cover of darkness, there were cases where somebody did something, assuming the Saxon regiment was still there, and all hell was let loose because they'd gone and it was the Prussian regiment, including, most sadly, the people who used to hold their fingers up above the parapet. and had them shot off, you know, by a friendly lot on the other side. But then, you know, it happened. You do it again, and you stand up to see, wake out why it isn't happening, and you get one between the eyebrows. That was the worst case of that. The person, I think, who was really hated on his, perhaps his only visit to the front was Winston Churchill, because he was sent to a segment of the front, visited a segment of the front, where actually the regiment was there because they'd been having such a terribly bad time, and they were sent to a quiet sector of the front to try to help them to get together and integrate the new volunteers, who were volunteers or conscripts, who had come into the battalion. And he just fired everything at the enemy and precipitated a gigantic confrontation, which nobody wanted or was prepared for.
At the back, please.
Yeah, your the Regeneration trilogy and subsequent works seem to indicate a profound interest, if not a fascination, in this era and the phenomenon of the First World War. Can I ask what initially aroused your interest and subsequently sustained it over a period of years?
I think what aroused my interest, and I think I was brought up by my grandparents, and it was with the war my grandfather fought in, and also, as it happened, with the war my stepfather had fought in. My grandfather had a bayonet wound, and my stepfather had been gassed. He was in the trenches at 15, and his lungs were certainly in a mess, but then he was a heavy smoker too. What sustained my interest is, it's not personal at all. It's the basic thing of we as a species are characterized by periodic massive slaughters of our own kind. And my question really is, why do we do this? And how on earth, given the extent of our weaponry, are we going to survive if we go on doing it? You know, 85 million dead since the end of the Second World War. Number of sheep in the same period killed by other sheep, zero. You know, this is us. This is mankind.
Well, on that, I fear that's the note we're going to have to end on, because time is running out. So I just thank all of you for coming, for all of your questions. Apologies to those who didn't get a chance. And, of course, especially thanks to Pat for coming.
Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological, and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcast offers. I dare you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.